New Year, one and all. Welcome back to Soft Revolution, our second year of existence, 2021, baby. I'm Torkel Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And today on the pod, we have an amazing guest for you a little later on. We have the legendary broadcaster, songwriter, musician, actor, I don't know, all around doer, Erica M.
Superwoman.
Yeah, like and certainly like a huge cultural figure in Canada. If you're someone who was alive in the 80s and 90s in Canada, Erica M. would have been somebody that was a huge part of your intake of culture. She was a VJ at Much Music back in the day when Much Music was a very innovative and very crazy place run by Moses Neimer. And we're going to talk to her about that, about whether or not that kind of independent media can ever exist again in this world. But mostly we had a great, great chat with Erica, who was incredibly generous with her time, about saying yes to things and about survival, you know. And one of the things I really admire about her is how many things she's done in her life. And when things disappeared, there was a new opportunity because she'd taken the time to make it. So we have a really cool conversation for you with Erica M. about surviving this shit that we're in. And we are still in the shit, Ali.
Big time.
My understanding was that once 2021 came, the virus would go away. We'd all be singing Kumbaya. And I personally feel betrayed. It seems like things have only gotten ramped up. I don't even know where to begin when we're going to talk about politics, quote unquote politics. I mean, what does that even mean anymore? So I'm going to start with this. What in your mind, Ali, are like the two biggest things we've got to tackle this year? Not as the world, but as people in the creative sphere, what's going to get us back? What are the two things we have to really focus on to get us back?
Number one, I really do think that, you know, the problems are so kind of existential right now that we actually do need to address the big political issues that are facing us. At the end of the day, they either allow us or disallow us to do all the things that we want to do. Mm-hmm. And the bottleneck right now is the political atmosphere and the virus. And if this is not solved, it is inherently going to be impossible for us to push forward. Now, do you think I'm wrong, Tork? Because I can't. You know, we started talking last year. There was this hope about the vaccines coming. Yeah. And I was a little more kind of reticent because I was like, the distribution of the vaccine is going to be incredibly difficult. And that's what we're finding out right now. Yeah. In Ontario, just in Ontario, they're making out plans. They're hoping to get 80,000 vaccines a week. 80,000 vaccines, there's 14 million people in Ontario. Let's say you get 10 million, that takes you to 70% herd immunity. Although Fauci is saying now you need 90% herd immunity. Thanks, Fauci. But even to get 70% of the population of Ontario, which is 10 million, you do some basic math. That's 125 weeks. That's 125 weeks. So we need to have this shit fixed, because otherwise we're just going to be doing the dance and nothing's going to go down.
So this leads,
it's happening.
This leads me to what I don't want to start this year off being a prick or being negative, but I do have to say this vaccine rollout thing is just kind of the cherry on top of the shit sundae. You know, what is wrong with the people we elect to public office? Why are they so incompetent? Why is there so much broad incompetence in our political class? They had 9 months to get ready for this. They had every single reason in the world to make this their number one priority. They had all the money they needed. They had everything, and they fucked it up. And it just feels crushing to me. And people say, well, this is, you know, don't say it'll take 10 years. We're going to ramp it up. Well, what evidence is there of that? You know, there
hasn't
been...
But the issue isn't supply. The issue is not supply.
No.
The issue is distribution. You know,
yeah.
We have hundreds of thousands of vaccines, close to, in Ontario in a freezer. It's just the distribution of it.
And it's a logistical issue. And that's what we fucking pay them to figure out. So how is it possible that they fucked this up this much? And there doesn't seem to be any real accountability. You know, this country, God bless it, you know, I'd rather have it be the way it is than the way some other countries we could mention are in terms of its volatility and its sort of insistence on being mild all the time. But where is our press? Where is the outrage? Where is the anger? Every single second that we're not putting vaccines in people's arms, we are risking the chance that one of those people is going to fucking die. How much more necessary and urgent can something possibly be? And why can't we hold our political class to account for this? You know, I've seen artist after artist after artist mention there are theaters empty all over the place. There are churches empty all over the place. There are nightclubs empty all over the place. There are people whose job it is to organize fucking Coachella. There are people whose job it is to organize the Stratford Festival who are free. They have nothing to do. Hire them. Teach them how to stick a needle in somebody's arm and then let them do it. How fucking complicated can that be? I don't get it. I just
well, I will
don't
say there is something that I am trying to, along with some other people, we are trying to organize getting vaccines distributed in the theaters. And the reason why there's a synergy to that, because first of all, the theater is like made for vaccine distribution because you have the lobby, which is the waiting area.
Right.
And then people could walk into the theater where a larger waiting area and then finally walk on stage. Everyone gets their moment of glory and they get the jab.
It's
what's beautiful about it is that this, so what can we do as artists, right? We can be pushing for this to be like, hey, we should be vaccinating people in these places, whether it's theaters, concert halls, movie theaters as well. But the main reason why I think we should do it is that it is a kind of like a PR event as well, too, because it is a reminder to people as to why, beyond the health reasons, why we vaccinate so that we can, again, congregate in a theater. Like, there are people, you know, it's now January. This thing started in March. There are people who haven't been to a theater since that.
There's your slogan right there. Vaccinate so we can congregate. Boom.
Vaccinate so we can congregate. And let me remind you, wow, remember this theater? Remember this concert hall?
Right.
Remember this? I mean, start vaccinating in the gyms. Like, right. I think that's what it should be doing. That's what we should be doing. All those places we can't go is where we should be vaccinating. Those are the centers that need to happen. And I'm certain. This is the thing that pisses me off about this whole thing. You know, we spoke to Alan Detsky in the second episode of this podcast, right? And we talked about the vaccine. And Alan Detsky was the chief of medicine at Mount Sinai. And he was telling me about what he envisioned. He said, you know, Ali, you're a young, healthy guy. And I'm telling you, there might be a thing where all of a sudden, you know, you're going to be have to put into service. You may have to go to the nursing homes and deliver food. And I was like, yes. Yes, I want to do that. Let me do that. What can I do? Let me be of service, because that is what character is. Character is not how you feel. I felt like shit, but I was thinking about what can I do? That's what character is, right? And so the character of our country needs to be uplifted a little bit. And so all of us fucking artists, we can be doing something right now. And that could be vaccinating people. That could be 100% vaccinating people.
And yet we're not doing it, and there doesn't seem to be any urgency to do it. You know, the other day I was listening to Bonnie Henry, the director of public health here in BC, giving her twice weekly update, and she talked about vulnerable sectors that are suffering, you know, and she talked about tourism, and she talked about restaurants, and she even talked about movie theaters, but she didn't talk about theaters. She didn't talk about rock clubs. She didn't talk about art galleries, because for some reason, we have been put into the file of expendable. It has been decided by the political class that if you lose something, it might as well be culture. And I know I've been going on about this for a long time, and I've been riding this emotional fucking roller coaster of feeling abandoned and then feeling like there might be some hope. Just so y'all know, we are really hoping that we're going to get Stéphane Gibaud, the Minister for Heritage, here on the show so that we can ask him some questions about the government's plans to help artists out of this pandemic. But it never comes up. And I wrote to a journalist who was at this Bonnie Henry news conference and said to him, please ask them about performing artists. What's their plan? What's the date? What are they doing to make it possible for us to ever do what we do again? It just isn't part of the conversation. Is that good enough? is this special pleading? Am I being a whiny bitch? Don't we have a right to be a part of the conversation? I mean, not all of the conversation, but surely we deserve a passing fucking remark about the state of complete and utter collapse that this industry has found itself in, and about the vacuum created in people's lives by our absence. This isn't just about me or you being able to make a living. This is about what having no art in your life does to people. It doesn't do good things to people. It's not good for society that no one can go and listen to music or see a play or look at an opera or watch a ballet. That is not good for psychological health. It's not good for the economy. It's not good for education. It's not good. Why can't we get some respect from the political class about this issue? None. Zero. And they won't even use us to stick fucking needles in people's arms because they just, I guess, don't believe we actually exist. We're like fairies in the forest. We're just something you hear about. We're not real. We just float in amber until the next time you need to see a fucking play. It's and then you look at, like, you know, Doug Ford or any of these guys bumbling along, trying to figure out how to do one goddamn thing right. And you look at all the people who are not just artists in the art world. People, as I said, who are tour managers, stage managers, executive directors of theaters. We got some brilliant minds. And we're sitting at home waiting.
Stage managers. You know who can organize the best vaccine distribution?
I mean, come on.
Stage managers.
Anybody knows who's ever worked with a stage manager knows this shit would be happening on time and under budget if stage managers...
It would be like marked. It would be marked. The glow tape would be there. They know exactly where to go. It'd be amazing.
It'd be amazing. Anyway.
I love the passion that we have, and we're not even at Trump.
Yeah. You know what? Let me just say this. We'll end this, but let me say this. If you feel the same way about it, and I know you do, I know there's people out there listening to this podcast who feel what I'm saying, don't go on fucking Twitter and say it. Don't go on Facebook and say it. Write to your local MP. Write to someone in power and express your opinions. It doesn't matter anymore what you say on social media. No one's listening. Nobody cares. It's a hellhole. It's a morass of shit. Don't waste your energy. I mean, do. Go ahead. I do. You know, unleash the steam valve if you need to. But if you really want things to change, we've got to do this in direct action. And that means talking to the people with power and letting them know we're out here and letting them know we're ready to work and we want to know what we can do to help. So yeah. I'm urging you all to do that. Please do that.
And it is important to talk about, though, the ultimate thing is that the lack of foresight, the lack of vision, the lack of creative thinking from our leaders is why we are here. And now that we are 10 months into this shit sandwich, we can look and we could say, okay, who actually is thriving and who has brought this virus down to ultimately zero and is allowing life to continue? I'm going to put China away because that's an authoritarian regime that don't count. But we have examples outside of this country and also inside of this country. Outside this country, we could look at New Zealand. We could look at Australia. Come From Away is happening in Australia, guys. They're rehearsing. It's coming back. Yep. And in New Zealand, obviously, we know. But we can also look straight to our Atlantic neighbors in Ontario and in Canada. You know, they created an Atlantic bubble. You weren't allowed to go in if you're not from there. And, you know, did they have some cases? Yes. But ultimately, their cases are like so minimal because they embarked in creative thinking. They pushed past short-termism. You know, this notion of like we're going to manage this virus and that it's like a steam valve. We're going to open it, then close it, open it, then close it. It is terrible for people. It's terrible for businesses, it's terrible for people's psychology. I was talking to you right before. I was like, let's say Stars, yes, go ahead. It's all good to go. And you guys plan this 100-person show. And then all of a sudden, a shutdown. If you're a restaurant, if you're any business, this is worse. Whereas if you go and you look at all the examples, what happened in Australia was to really strive to get it down to zero. That's really what it's about. And it wasn't just we are going to do this. It was really creative ideas surrounding that ambitious and visionary objective. So in Australia, when you go, you have to pay and you isolate in a hotel. You don't make an isolation promise. They fucking make you isolate. Yeah. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. This isn't like, I swear, Justin, I'm going to isolate. Yeah. No. So it's just this constant lack of foresight. And that actually does take us to Trump, this lack of foresight and this insurrection. Why are people surprised by what happened? If you had any idea and if you were able to connect the dots, none of this should have been surprising, right?
No. I mean,
crazy.
And let me say this, because it's something that's come up in my household a lot. My wife right now is working on her MA, and so she's reading a lot of plays. And we were talking yesterday, like, anybody who says that the Trump story isn't Shakespearean, really, I have to strongly disagree. It's like, it's the most sure, he's not as interesting a character as Richard III, but it's ending the same fucking way. And when this pandemic is over, who's going to be the, who's written the plays that really reflect what's happening in the world today? The artist that comes to mind for me most immediately is a 450-year-old playwright. He wrote this shit. It's incredible. And obviously, Donald Trump has not read Macbeth all the way to the end. You know, he just got to the bit where the witches told him he was going to be Thane of Cawdor. But he didn't read Act 4 because motherfucker's head ends up on a spike. You know what I mean? And that is ultimately, rhetorically, what has happened to Donald Trump. He is a man now who has nothing. His rats that have been crawling over him and feeding off his bloated corpse for 4 years have now left his corpse to move on to another one. And he has turned on his own sad followers, of course, because he's a coward who's just trying to save his skin. I mean, that video yesterday that he put out.
Oh, what a little baby.
The hostage video is like...
Bro, it was a deep fake. It wasn't him. It was a deep fake.
Okay, Ali, we should not be spreading conspiracy theories on our podcast. There's enough. We'll leave that to Joe Rogan. But seriously, that did look like a fucking deep fake, man.
No, stop it.
Well, it really did, though. And even if it wasn't a deep fake, it was a deep fake because you know he didn't mean a goddamn word of it.
That
he was, as a person who likes to think about the dramatic moment in things, imagine the moment where somebody said to him, look, buddy, you can rant and rave all you want. If you don't read this script into that camera right now, you're going to be charged with sedition tomorrow morning. You know that shit happened. You know that's why he did it. Because someone said to him, do you understand that you might be going to prison for this? For a long fucking time? So get it together and read this script. The whole thing, as you say, is so unsurprising. How else could this possibly have ended? I mean, when the man was elected 5 years ago, I cried. I'm assuming you did. Everyone I know literally cried because we knew what it meant. We knew that we were going to end up here. And all I can say is we got lucky because he didn't get elected again. And because there is a vaccine and because... American democracy, such as it is, did withstand this assault. But, Hitler, the beer hall pushed was in 1923, right? 1922. Hitler took over in 1933. So this isn't the end of something.
Yeah,
this is the
sure.
beginning. This mm-hmm. is both the fourth act of Macbeth, and it's also the very fucking beginning of it. And I think that As artists and as people who are trying to culturally interpret what's happening right now, there is this a compulsion to draw a circle around it and to look at it as the end of a narrative and to say, okay, now moving on, how can we look back on the Trump years? I think the Trump years have just begun. And that is what really, really frightens me, is that outside the constraints of power, outside the constraints of the judicial system and the executive branch and all those things that have made Donald Trump unable to, like, you know, literally shoot a guy in the middle of Fifth Avenue, what will he be like? And what will the 78 million people who voted for him be like?
Yeah,
and
that's
how
who I
do
think
we
about.
Get in touch with them? Now,
that's who I think about a lot. You
yeah,
know, the,
now this
the
brings
who
me
stormed.
This but brings I, me, I, Ali, I do, to something yes, you've been talking about, and I want you to talk about more, which is this is social media. This is the yeah. internet. This doesn't happen without the internet. So now that we've kind of come to the conclusion that the internet has been, on the whole, bad for society, what next, Ali? What the fuck do we do to get those people out of this cult and get them back to some realm of sanity? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I was reading this incredible piece by Charlie Warzel for the New York Times. I think this guy should win the Pulitzer because, you know, what he's written about just social media, the silent conservative majority, QAnon. Like, if you were aware of QAnon and if you were aware of the cesspool of the internet, none of this was surprising to you. But his most recent piece in the New York Times really kind of like sums, really opened my brain to the depths of this. And that he mentioned that, look, like, we have focused so much on the supply. And we talk about social media, we talk about Trump. But we need to start, as human beings, start asking ourselves, why the demand? Why the demand for this? Why do people want these types of conspiratorial thinking, these fantasies, to make sense of a world that they do not understand? So we need to really think about how we talk to one another and how we make sense of this world that is deeply confusing. But the final thing that I've been thinking about is that Trump's first video, not this quote unquote deep fake, but his first video was that one triggered me. First of all, it was the I love you or we love you, you're very special. It triggered me as a brown man because I was like, he will never say that about me, number one. But the other reason why it triggered me was at first he came out and he said, you know, this was rigged. It was stolen. It was the biggest theft. Now go home. Uh-uh. That's not how it works.
No.
These individuals have created such an imagination, such like a fake world. Their imagination is so profound and they've written this story in their brain that all of this is real, that the election was stolen, that, you know, Dominion changed the systems, that Mike Pence that day was going to do it. And then when reality hits them, the majority of people don't just say, oh, okay, gonna go home now. It is a profoundly disorienting experience. And that's what drove them into the Capitol. Mm-hmm. What drove them into the Capitol was that, wait, you're telling me the reality isn't this thing that I view as true? Then I'm going to make it real. And so even though Donald Trump, my prediction is he's going to resign. I think it's going to be very Nixonian in that they go and they say, look, Don, we got the votes to impeach, so you should go. And I think that's what might happen. Mm-hmm. But those individuals have gone to the brink. They've gone to the gates thinking that they're going to see heaven, and it ain't there. Yeah. So they're going to build the gates. They're going to make it.
I saw a fascinating piece of footage that I haven't seen again, but it sort of passed me by as I was watching some piece of footage of the storming of the Capitol, of a guy walking in, screaming as he walked in, literally like 20 seconds later walking out and saying, we've been in there, there ain't nothing in there. And you realize, yeah, right, they thought they were going to go in there and see like pedophiles actively.
Pedophiles, yeah.
Like that there'd be piles of gold upon which slaves would be kept. Like they really actually thought that. And, you know, I'm just, as we're speaking here, I'm watching a piece of video go by of people harassing Lindsey Graham at Reagan National Airport, calling him a traitor.
Right.
Like this man who has been, you know, shown filial duty to Donald Trump for the last 4 years, this suck up, the ultimate ass kissing toady of Donald Trump, because he at the last moment is now trying to save his skin by pretending that, oh, this is just a step too far. He has now been turned on as well. They are all turning on each other. And yes, there's a certain amount of schadenfreude and glee in watching the whole thing fall apart. But this energy and this, as you say, this delusion, it's not just going to peter out. It is now an actual concrete building. people are living inside an imaginary fucking box. And yeah. if we don't crush that box, I don't see what help there is. And to me, so here's Ali, way to crush as you've it. There said, are way to crush it. But as you've said before, let me just finish this thought. What else can there, what other solution is there but enforcement, law? We got to control these private companies. You know, the part of the whole thing about Trump turning down the funding bill, the relief bill, the coronavirus relief bill, was that he wanted this Section 230 passed. Well, guess what? He's right.
He is.
He's right. Private media companies like Facebook and Twitter should be held accountable for what is published on their fucking platform. And they should be able to be sued if they publish lies. So, like, this is the crazy thing about the reality we're living in, is that now Trump is such an evil figure that he, everything that even he, by accident, he espouses that might potentially be a good idea is flushed down the toilet because it's attached to Trump. But something needs to happen. We can't just let this unfettered growth of these big tech companies continue without some sense of accountability. It's got to change. That's the totally first right. step, is it not?
Yes. And so let me just quickly explain. Section 230 is a law that basically says internet companies are not responsible for what is put by their users. Now, you could step back and say, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. But unfortunately, it doesn't apply to social media, because social media actually has the algorithm. And the algorithm right. pushes things out. And it isn't just this open forum. It doesn't work that way. So Section 230, now whether or not you want to get rid of it or whether or not it needs to be definitely amended, 100%. So we've spoken about, you know, the restraint. Like, there needs to be massive legislation in regards to this. We've spoken about it, about that. But there are two other things that this whole experience has made me think about. Number one, when you watch the news, like, if you were like tapped into the whole QAnon world, if when you watch the mainstream news, they're very surprised by it. And it just kind of goes to show you that the focus of our mainstream news media, the media that the majority of people consume, needs to kind of step up a little bit. And then the other thing, again, the theme is to look around the world, because, you know, we're not the only ones with these problems, but there are other countries that have found solutions. We need to teach a profound level of media literacy to our children and to our public. I'm going to give two examples. In Finland, they teach children in grade school how to discern fact from fiction, how to go through social media and recognize what fake news is and what isn't. And they also teach invariably that lying is not something that should be commended. And in fact, it is dangerous. And what you are doing is you are hurting me and you're hurting my tribe. It's wrong. The second place that we could look at is the Ukraine. The Ukraine, they have on their nightly newscast, they go through the fake news and the disinformation, because they are neighbors to Russia, and Russia obviously has a motive to essentially take over that country again. They go through and they say, hey, this thing is fake, this is fake, this is real, this is fake. And I actually think it's time for our politicians to really be able to be tapped into the bullshit that's everywhere, and they got to step up and talk about it. That guy Sterling, the Georgia, I was loving it. I was watching CNN before the Georgia election, and he went up there and for 30 minutes, he goes, you know what? I'm going to debunk some stuff. And he just stood there and he went boom, boom, boom over every single piece of garbage that has been, you know, being pushed on social media and on QAnon forums or Facebook or whatever about the stealing of the election. Now, is everyone going to listen to that? No, but I think it's important for politicians to view this as so existential that they need to go up there and say, hey, look, okay, Doug Ford, maybe not Doug Ford, he's not the best speaker, but someone like Doug Ford should go out there and say, hey, look, a smart Doug Ford. He'd be like, hey, look, I am hearing that this is just the flu. I need to explain to you guys why it's not. Mm-hmm. In 2019, 224 people in Canada died of the flu. How many thousands have died already? And this is with us with this mitigation. 224 in 2019 died with us all getting lit. We were in the clubs. We were in the concerts. We were doing everything. So just imagine. And the other thing I keep on hearing is like, there is a 99.9% chance of survival. That number is wrong. It is 1% under the best of circumstances, and it goes all the way up to 9% in the worst of circumstances in Mexico. And that number is directly correlated with how busy our hospitals are. So whatever you guys are hearing on social media, I want to address these things. We have to like really tap into the kind of like cess of the internet and like really start to talk openly about it.
And it doesn't just have to do with
let's talk.
It doesn't just have to do with you know location. It has to do with, I just read yesterday, Ali, 78% of the people with COVID-19 in Toronto right now are members of a visible minority.
Yeah.
78%, dude.
Yeah.
This is turned into a class disease. It is turned into a disease that affects the poor, the unheard, the unseen, the homeless, the elderly. And my great fear is that that is where it will end too, that it will just get small enough that it just ravages those communities and the rest of us ultimately forget that it's happening.
And yeah, this whole great equalizer thing is bullshit.
But just, we're going to get to the interview with Erica soon, but there's just one more point that I wanted to make about all this, which is I just read an interesting article in Wired about this exact thing, about social media's accountability. Facebook recently changed their algorithm to promote more positive stories and more stories from your friends about their personal life and to demote negative stories. They immediately saw a drop in usage. Now, that's a depressing, that's a depressing thing to notice about humankind, which is that we are drawn to the negative, whether it's bad remarks about us or bad remarks about other people. Everybody likes bitchy gossip. But the other thing is that they then said, oh, well, there's a drop in usage. We got to go back to our old algorithm. That's where the psychopath element of capitalism comes in.
And
how is that allowed? How is a man who clearly has sociopathic tendencies like Mark Zuckerberg, a man who is willing to put his profit motive and his power in the world ahead of what he knows, what science, what his own algorithm has shown him, which is that the only reason people are using his shitty website is to fuel their anger and hatred and negativity. How the fuck do you let that man just continue with his business?
It's Frankenstein's monster. You destroy the fucking monster. That's what you do. It's like, talk about stories that we could look to.
So to me, it's like, I've kind of come to at the end of this week, I am a person who has tried my best to consider the fact that there may be some kind of conversation to be had about conservatism. You know, well, you have different ideas about how the economy works and how to get people ahead. And you might have different ideas about the internet and what corporate responsibility is. And I'm sorry, but I've kind of come to the end of this conversation. If you can look at what happened on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, if you can look at what this man has wrought, what big media, what big tech have let this man perpetrate on our world, and still say that the capitalist system is a healthy system, that our political system is healthy, and that big tech doesn't have too much influence in our world, I really can't have a conversation with you anymore. I just can't do it. I can't argue about this anymore. You don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You're living in denial. It's perfectly obvious. And I'm not in the changing minds business. So it's like, how do we just elect people who are willing to accept that reality and act on it? And you know what we need, Ali? We need more people like you in politics, my friend. That's what we need.
Well, you never know.
I'm just saying.
Yo, but I will say one other thing though too. This, talk about a tweet. This was amazing. This, I forget her name, but the Washington Post reporter, she tweeted, she was like, guys, I'm hearing a lot of like, you know, because the crazy right wing is pushing that Antifa somehow did this. Let me just address this one. Let me go like smart Doug Ford and address this one. If it's Antifa, why do we love them? And why are they special? Number two, if it's Antifa, don't you think they would take a mask mandate pretty seriously? Like, you don't Antifa and show your face, okay?
It's you don't say, I'm Doug Schmo from Idaho and I've just stolen Nancy Pelosi's fucking...
I know, these people were proud.
Enough already.
But here's the thing. So she said, she goes, guys, don't listen to this. I'm hearing a lot of like conspiracy theories on the internet. Please send them this article from the Washington Post. And you click it, paywall. You can't even see it. You got to pay like $100 a year. Now, look, I'm all for that. Sign up for our Patreon. I'm all for it. But we have to also think about that. The other reason I'm thinking about this is like, if you have, I'm going to say hours, it's going to take you days. But the most recent New Yorker is like the year of the plague, chronicles the entire situation here. Right. This piece is very long, but you are going to come out with such a clear idea of why we are where we are. And I will tell you, there are some heroes and there are some zeros, and nobody actually comes out like perfect. Even Fauci, you read that, wow, he was pretty slow. Another really crazy tidbit about like, why is this vaccine so fast? Oh my God. You know, this thing, crystallography, only came out as like this technology that allows you to see the entire protein of the virus, the spike protein of the virus, right? That happened. That was a technological breakthrough that occurred in 2013. If this pandemic occurred in 2012 and we didn't have crystallography, 5 years for a vaccine. But I go, wow, Ali Momin with his fucking privilege, being able to read the fucking New Yorker, look at this. But I go to myself, you know, 99% of like society doesn't have that privilege of like knowing the nuance of things. And that's why it's like the privilege needs to live in people merely being part of the institution that is this country or the country that you're in. And that, you know, equality of results is like a bedrock foundation of a functioning democracy. And one of the results, like we measure results by prosperity, we measure results by like money, we measure results by whatever, but we have to start measuring equality of results in how cultured are people? How much are their souls enriched? How much are their minds enlightened? If we don't, if all we go to, as you say, to this capitalism being the only important thing, money being the only important thing, we're going to fucking kill each other.
Well, this is where we end up.
It's not going to work.
This is
where we end up.
It's not enough. So I think it's, you know, this year of all years is about change and about not just changing, you know, ourselves, which is important to do. And God knows there's going to be some reckoning for all of us, but demanding that our systems change too, and demanding that they respond to what's happening instead of just letting with the vaccine, whether it's the vaccine rollout or it's social media's control over our conversation or our political system, whatever it is, everybody knows what needs to change. It's starkly clear. You can credit Trump with that at least. He sure has made it clear what the problem is. And so, you know, I think that that's got to be our focus for the year. And that's a good place to jump to Erica M. and to our conversation with her, because Erica is a changer. She responds to change with action and with saying yes to things. And she's got a lot of great things to say about that in her chat with her. So here it is on Soft Revolution, Erica M. You know, first of all, I'm nervous because you're one of my favorite interviewers. I've watched many, many interviews that you've done with people I love over the years, and you know, you've gotten them to reveal things that I needed to see that blew my mind. So thank you for that. And I hope I don't fuck this up too badly. But I want to start with this. Like, how are you? How's it going over there? I'm assuming you're in Ontario.
So I've been locked down with my family since last March, like the rest of the world. Yeah. My kids are older. I have a 17 and a 20-year-old. So in a way, I'm lucky. Yeah. And in a way, I feel really bad for my kids because this is the time in their lives when they're supposed to be out causing trouble.
Yeah.
And they're not. So, I mean, they've been really fantastic. I would say that like myself and like my husband, they both are using their time in creative ways, which is really exciting for me to see. And for me, this lockdown, I'm an introvert to begin with, and I live in my head. So this lockdown in many ways has been a bit of a gift for me because I get to have conversations like this, for example, but then I get to leave the room really quickly. Right. I also have been able to collaborate with people virtually and come up with some really interesting projects because there's nothing else to distract us, really. And we're all kind of desperate, not just to create, but to earn a living.
Yeah.
So the, you know, the the vibe is very different.
Yeah. And, I mean, this is, we started this podcast as, you know, we're both people who are very engaged with politics and with progressive politics and with the, and it sort of came out of the idea that, you know, art and cultural thought, imaginative thought, empathetic thought needed to be brought into policy discussions more. And we wanted to kind of make an advocacy podcast about that, but it's pretty quickly turned into a kind of survival manual for anybody who is creative in this world. And
well, if I'm going to just jump in there for a second, because yeah. The concept that you have about, you know, adding empathy into policy, et cetera, is such a rational, smart, insightful direction to be thinking, kind of like the leader in New Zealand seems mm-hmm. to be that kind of a leader. And, you know, the results speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. The problem is that that kind of leadership is often embraced by women, and women are afraid to get into politics because mm-hmm. it's become so ugly. It is
good point.
Is that the reason, do you think, Erica? I mean, the obvious reasons of like the patriarchy and society being built to dissuade women from places of power, do you think there's a real, like, if you talk to your female friends, is there a sense that they don't want to expose themselves to public life, to the cruelties of public life these days?
100%. And just look at, I can't remember her name now, but she's in Trudeau's cabinet, who was, you know, stalked in real life. I mean, obviously horrific things said about her in social media.
Judy Raybould. Do you mean Judy Raybould?
No, there was someone else. I can't remember which minister.
It could be any woman, right?
Tourism,
they've all had horrific things. Yeah.
And, you know, it's just become really horrible out there. And I jumped on social media about 12 years ago. I joined Twitter, and it really was the happiest time of my life back then. And I'm not
exaggerating. It was amazing back in the day. It was amazing when it first came out.
I made such good friends who are still to this day some of my best friends. I grew a business on social media, and it was not ugly. It was the opposite. It was, if you said the wrong thing, you would be shunned, and your sort of reputation and your ability to climb socially would be gone. Something happened probably around the time that Trump joined Twitter, and it is now fair game to say anything to anybody. So how can anybody speak their mind freely and suggest, you know, powerful or unique ideas when they become targets?
How do you talk to your son about this, Erica? How do you talk to your son about using social media?
Oh, we talk about it all the time. My kids.
And what does he think? Like, where is he at, and where do you want him to go?
My kids are so kind. I mean, they've been raised by me. I am unabashedly forever kind. Even if you fuck with me, I will be kind back to you. Honestly, because that to me is the best way to operate. Because when you're kind, it stops everybody in their tracks. It's the best way of fighting a war, I think.
And so do they engage with social media, or are they sort of like, it's a cesspit, I want nothing to do with it? Because I find my 11-year-old daughter, who's nearly 12 now, really sees social media as a kind of deviant activity. Like, she has been raised by us, who've raised that issue with her, but among her and her friends, there's this sense that, like, that's for weirdos. You know, that is where the discussion goes off the rails. That's a dangerous place. And I'm personally glad she feels that way. It's sad that that's what's happened, because I think you're right that there was enormous potential in the social linking of social media. But is that where your kids are at too? Or is it in their lives and they just try to use it better?
My son uses it very wisely. He uses it sparingly. He walks to his own beat. My daughter, completely immersed in the world of social media. That's her lifeline. However, she now is 17, so she's starting to wake up a little bit, and she's understanding how some of her friends on social media are gorgeous and their lives are so together. But then when she talks to them or someone who knows them, she finds out that so-and-so is completely depressed and can't get out of bed. And so she's starting to understand the facade that social media allows, and therefore to believe less and less of what she sees.
And it's a double edged sword, that, isn't it? Because it also, not only does it allow you to create a fictional reality about your life that hides the problems you have, but it also kind of hides the totality of who you are in a good way as well. That whatever you do on social media, good or bad, is who you are now. There is no avatar. It's just yourself. That's what really frightens me.
Well, actually, I use social media, I think, I think I'm awesome at it because I do and use it to talk about what interests me. I have a point of view. Mm-hmm. I don't use it very often. I'm not sort of loud about my political beliefs, but I'm consistent. Mm. Small drips all the time, the same message, consistent, or everything is in line. But it's interesting. Someone said to me, you know, I feel like I know you because I follow you on social media. And I go, you don't know me. I'm only giving you what I want you to know. You have no idea who I really am, but you do have a sense of what is important to me and what my values are.
You've just launched this podcast, which is called The Reinvention of the VJ. I listened to the George Strombolopoulos episode today, which I loved. He's a wonderful human. And I thought it was, in my age range, it's like an amazing podcast because it goes back and talks to all those people who were on Much Music and involved in the cultural scene when I was growing up and when I was a young adult in Canada. And I love the title because to me, so much of what you've done over the last 30 years is about reinvention. You started in one industry, which was the video world, the world of a world in which music videos controlled what was happening in the music industry. And you have gone through the collapse of that paradigm. You have gone through the collapse of commercial radio to some degree. You've gone through the collapse of City TV as this very radical solo entity that it was. And you keep swimming. And I think that's something that I've managed to do in my life as well. It's sort of like, I do this, I do that, whatever's in front of me, I do. And this, I think, is so important right now for artists and creative people to hear. And so we try to provide this advice from people like you to them. How do you do it? Is it an act of necessity, or are you looking ahead all the time and thinking, I'm not going to stay in this place too long, I'm moving on?
When I worked at Much Music, I had a hat company where I designed hats, manufactured them, and sold them to boutiques around the country. I used to do lots of voiceovers. I started a songwriting career with Tim Thorney, and we started our own record label, and we put out a whole bunch of albums and won Juno Awards and Country Music Awards. I wrote a book. This is all while I was at Much Music. Huh. I was in a play called Unidentified Human Remains, again, yes, while I was at Much Music. So I've always planted seeds. That's how I describe it, where there are creative opportunities for me to try out my potential, I guess.
And is that a question of always saying yes? I mean, is that sort of like being open to what people offer you? Or is it more about you starting that stuff out of your own desire to change?
I would love the opportunity to have the opportunity of saying yes.
Right.
But mostly, I don't usually get offered things. Mm. So everything that I have pursued is because I made it happen. Mm. But that's not true. There are some, I could, you know, start naming some of the things that have occurred in my life where I got this weird email or a phone call and I'm like, really? Me? But those are so rare. Most things in my life are because I make it happen.
Well, there is that part of your mythology, right? Which is like that sort of Jane Mansfield story of you, that you were a receptionist at City TV and were plucked out of obscurity or whatever. But that's not actually the truth, is it? You had already been working in radio and you had a degree in broadcasting. And so you put yourself in the right place to get that gig. It wasn't like, who's this person, right? It's like,
well, also, from the time I was 16, I knew that I wanted to work in the music business. I just right. didn't know how because I was 16. So I was going to school at Marianopolis in Montreal. I was obviously CEGEP, and Chaume FM had a contest where your school could win a free concert by Max Webster. And I was like, we need to win that.
It's
we
gotta
need
happen.
To win that. So I started to run the contest in my school. This wasn't a school contest. It was called School Spirit. So they asked their listeners to write in and say what school they came from, and the school that got the most postcards would win this concert. Well, I went, screw that. I'm going to make us win. So I went into the student services area, and I asked them to give me a whole bunch of paper, and I photocopied the paper into 8 little squares. Each was sort of a postcard, and people would come into the cafeteria, and fill out these postcards. We would slice them into 8 and then put them into a box. And when I had a few boxes full, I delivered them to Chaume FM. And those bastards announced what I did to other schools and said, Marianopolis is now doing this in their cafeteria. What about you, other schools? Well, we ended up not winning.
Ugh.
So that pissed me off. So I organized a march, a parade from Marianopolis to Chaume FM down to Green Avenue. We had about 100 students in cars, motorcycles, bicycles, walking with signs, chanting, "We want Max." And we closed off Green Avenue, and the DJ hung out of the window on the 3rd floor and said, "Who's in charge?" And everybody yelled, "Erica." So when I was 16, I was interviewed by Chaume FM about why Max was so important, et cetera. So we never did win that concert, but I did get to meet the people and got to walk inside Chaume FM, which right. is when you're 16. It was amazing. But then a few months later, I saw Rob Braid, who was the program director at Chaume FM. I had met him when I went into the office. And so I walked up to him at the Cars concert. And I said, "Hi, Rob, my name's Erica. Can I have a job at Chaume?" And he looked at me funny and said, "This isn't the right time to be talking about this. I'm here to see a band." He said, "You can call my secretary and set up an appointment." And so I did. And I went there. He sat me down and I said, "Can I have a job?" And he said, "No." And I asked him, "Why not?" And he said, "Well, you're still a student. You have to stay in school." He said, "But if you want, you could be my music librarian. I'll let you come in here every day. You won't get paid, but you get to be part of the radio station, and your job is to keep all the albums organized. Want it?" I was like, "Hell yeah." So when I was 16, I was working at Chaume FM.
Right. So even what I love about that story is he was like, "This isn't the right time," but obviously it was. It's always the right time, right?
Well, it wasn't
the right
time. If
you see that opportunity, talk to the person, say something,
always.
Put yourself in the room,
always.
Get yourself noticed. And
Listen, I mean, I do speaking engagements, and that's all I talk about is mm-hmm. why it's essential that we are all opportunists, no matter what it is that you do in life. If you want something in life, you have to go and get it. No one will hand it to you on a silver platter. And if they are, if you do see that silver platter, know that there's someone's agenda somewhere. So nothing comes for free.
We last met for the first time in a very strange way, which is that we met on stage during a play and then sort of never saw one another again. But in that space of 10 minutes when you were a guest at the Stars Together play at the Crow's Theater in Christmas of Jesus, whatever it was, 1923, it feels like now. And it was awesome. We had a different guest every night come in at this particular pivotal moment in the play. And it was a very tough gig because you had to come on and improvise with the band at a moment in the show when things were at a point of cataclysm. And, some people really were deers in the headlights. Some people were amazing. But I remember our conversation very distinctly because of how much I felt. So much of the time when we would do these guest appearances, I would be the person who would have to sort of steer it through. And there'd be this anxiety that I'd feel as I tried to get the guest on stage and off stage without them feeling, you know, embarrassed or bored or whatever. I just wanted them to have a good time and for the audience to have a good time. But the day you did it, I felt like I could just suddenly I was the person being, I was the guest. Like you had this magical ability to sort of turn it around. And I found the conversation incredibly easy. Now, I know you've told me that you don't remember that conversation, which I totally get because you were on stage doing this crazy thing. But what we really talked about was sort of this, was about durability and about accepting when terrible shit happens and trying to find a way to use it. And I think this is like the big crisis for creative people right now, is not just that they're thinking about pivoting, they're thinking about leaving what they do or trying to do something new or starting a podcast, whatever it is, but they're also thinking in terms of their own real sense of identity, like who am I? As you've changed careers and you've changed what you've done over the years or you've tried new things, what can you say to people about not losing a sense of identity? How do you maintain that peace of mind that you are Erica and that you can do different things without attaching yourself to being, you know, the VJ or the musician or whatever it is that got you this, the last successful thing you did?
I think part of it is not caring what other people think you are and just doing whatever it is that you love to do, whatever it is. And if you don't love making art anymore, then don't worry what people will think if you want to leave and pursue something else. Mm-hmm. I think you have to do what you love. You have to do that thing that makes you feel giddy when you're doing it. And I'm saying that because I recently felt that feeling because I had stopped feeling it for a while. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. Like I've been running this website for moms and this agency for moms, right, for the last 14 years. And, you know, getting a little tired of it, to be honest. So out of the blue, this is one of those out of the blue stories, I get an email from someone saying, hey, I have a friend who is looking for someone to write a theatrical piece. And I told them all about you and he wants you to do it. Like, wait, what? You talking about? I was like, absolutely, I'm in. I never let on that I didn't really have the skills to do it or that I didn't think I had the skills. I said, sure, of course I can do it. And for the first part of the pandemic, I wrote a show with this guy on FaceTime. He's in LA. I was in Toronto. And we wrote this really cool show called Out of the Books. And it was supposed to premiere at this in Scotland at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And oh, yeah. As I was writing it, every day I'd feel my heart start to speed up when I'd be in the process of writing the characters. I was like, oh my God, this turns me on. I love this so much. I would read the script to my family. I'd go, do you like this? Like I was on fire. And then the pandemic hit and those fucking pandemic wrecked our play. Couldn't do it.
Wow.
So this guy and I decided to, in quotation marks, pivot. And we rewrote the show as a YouTube series. So it's almost all done now. And we shot it with actors in the UK and in the States. Everybody shot their scenes on iPhones against green screens. We directed it through Zoom, and now it's just being assembled and being posted to YouTube. But man, I was living the dream. You know how much money I made from this? Almost nothing. But I know that this is something that I need to do more of. I know it. My body told me. You don't even have to think. You can feel it. So I think to answer your question, you have to tap into yourself. And you need to figure out like, what is it that turns you on? And there is a good chance that what turns you on may not be what pays the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Some of us have to work a day job to pay to do the things that we love to do. That's life.
Erica, I love that you that story and you explaining that, because I was going to ask you, when do you say yes? What is it about a offer or an idea that makes you go yes and you embark? So joy is the answer. But when do you say no?
I'm going to tell you something so funny. Yeah. I mostly say yes because everybody conks out. Like, I just say yes to everything, because usually people can't get their stuff together.
Right.
So I say yes because it makes me look good. And then when they actually come to do it, they never call you back, or the thing doesn't fly or whatever.
So true.
Funding didn't go through. We didn't get the grant.
I didn't want to do this fucking podcast. I never thought Allie would actually get the software, and now I've been doing it for a year. Stuck. No, I think that's really true.
I think you should always say yes. I mean, there is something to be said for understanding the underlying objective from that person, the intention of the person who's asking you to do something. Do they stand to make a large amount of money and you get nothing? No, thanks. So there are those kinds of conversations to be had. But for me, I live life for experiences. So if you say no, then you lose that opportunity to learn something and experience something new.
Go ahead, Allie.
No, I have a basic question of like, tell me about your upbringing. Why are you this wonderful? Like, give me the gist of like, can you actually tell me why, you know, you just seem so open and inviting? And is there anything that you could look back on in your life and say, oh yeah, XYZ brought me to this? Or is this nature? Is this nurture? What's going on?
Have you met my mom?
No, I think I want to now.
My mom, she died a year and a half ago, which is a tragedy. My mother basically made me who I am, and my sister, who is also a force of nature. When I was about 8 years old, I came home from school and I was really hungry, and told my mom that she could order pizza. And she said, actually, tonight you're going to be ordering pizza. And I was like, Mom, I'm 8. And she said, but if you want supper, you're going to order pizza. So we had a bit of a Mexican standoff. I marched up to my room. She didn't order the damn pizza. And I came downstairs. I was like, Mom, I'm starving. She said, order the pizza. It was Pendelli's. You know, if you're from Montreal, you know Pendelli's pizza was the best. So my mom made me call the Pendelli's place. Hi, America. I'd like to order a pizza, please, with extra cheese. And the guy goes like, you know, 30 minutes or it's free, or, you know, one of those things. And sure enough, I was wolfing down this pizza. And my mom said, so what did we learn here? And I was like, pizza is really good when you're hungry. And she's like, no, you never can be afraid to ask for what you want. You have to ask for what you want. She said, what's the worst thing that would have happened with a pizza guy if he hung up on you and didn't take you seriously? You'd call another pizza guy and you'd give them your business. Right. And those words, that don't be afraid to ask, is, she kind of drilled it into my brain. So those are the words that were in my head when I saw Rob Braid at the Montreal Forum. It was like, don't be afraid to ask.
And yeah, it's like life is a bunch of pizza guys for you. Lunch is just a,
That's all it is. And I don't even see the obstacle. I just go there and I ask, because really, what is the worst thing that could happen? People will say no. And I will tell you, I've been turned down so many times, so many times. I can't even begin to tell you. And I'm still okay. And I'm a little bit beat up. And I'm a little bit hesitant at times to ask, because I know that probably the answer is going to be no, but I ask anyway, and it's still no. But sometimes people say maybe, so I get a little bit further ahead. You know, it's hard being an entrepreneur, especially in the arts, and it's hard being weird. I'm weird. I don't fit in. So some people, like you, appreciate that, but mainstream media doesn't. Moses was a freak, so he liked me because I was a freaky girl. But the mainstream people, they don't get me.
Do you think anything like City TV could happen again? Was that a thing of its time? Or is there a way that we could make that kind of independent media happen again?
I think it could happen. You just need someone freaky like Moses to have the dollars to make it come alive. Like you heard the podcast with George, and that's kind of something that I asked him. Did you get that far into the podcast? Because it was later in the talk. When I said to him, because I know he's a very unique thinker and quite a force of nature and has a ton of respect in the industry. So
yes.
I was sort of asking him that question. Listen, if you could do anything and run some type of media, what would it look like? He didn't really answer the question, which I was disappointed because I wanted to hear his vision. And then I would have said to him, can I be a part of it? I don't have the energy. I mean, I've been running my own business. Like at one point, my YMC business, so the Yummy Mummy Club, the M&Co agency, we had 50 people working for me. And we were really on fire. It was fantastic. And the challenge of the running of the business is different than the art of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah.
I just got tired of running the business. I don't have a business background. So I want to find people who want to leverage my enthusiasm and skills and creativity and vision, kick-assness, who have the business acumen and the dollars. And then you and I, you guys and I, we can build something amazing because there is such a hunger for it.
Yeah.
The problem right now is that the mainstream media is run by old white people who are afraid. Their reason to run their businesses is purely to maintain the status quo and earn more money. It isn't really to innovate and challenge what's out there now. Much Music did it, City TV did it, and they made money. There is money to be made, as you can see in the world of social media. The difference, if I were to run some sort of a media of some sort where you get to curate the hosts or the storytellers or the performers, is that you can block the bad. Meaning, if I were to have run Twitter, I would have kicked everybody bad off.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it would have been my definition of what bad is.
But it's your company.
That's right. I would have been brave enough to say, here's our code of ethics, and you're not following them. So either you change your behavior or go start your own. Get out.
Yeah, this thing of ethics, you know, the foundational aspect of, or even aesthetics, short of ethics, aesthetics, there doesn't seem to be considerations of those two foundations when creative businesses are started now. And I feel like if somebody could come up with a way, this goes to the heart of, you touched on something just now that really goes to the heart of what this podcast is about, which is how do we find a way to when those business students are in business school, when those future entrepreneurs and those people who can crunch the numbers and do think big on an economic level are learning how to do that, how do we inject the notion that creativity can be profitable into their lives? There seems to be this huge divide of like, well, you can make art and suffer, or you can make money and not do anything of value. And I reject it out of hand, I think, and City TV and all kinds of things have shown us that that's bullshit. And I feel like that is, God, every artist is looking for a business person who gets what we do. And every kind of business person, ultimately, I think, would be so enriched by finding an artist who gets what they do.
There's no way that Mark Zuckerberg would have made Facebook into how it is now if he was an artist, or even if he wasn't an artist, if he studied any humanities, political science, philosophy, literature. It just wouldn't happen. He would have the foresight and the imagination that letting everything run wild while it sounds good, you know, it's seeing beyond what's merely in front of you, you know, so to incorporate art into that would have been such a wonderful, necessary thing.
Yeah, well, that what you're talking about is having a strong vision. And I think that's why people loved Much Music, is because it had very strong values and it understood what its role was, what its function was. interesting how the music industry died, and it died because older white men ran the industry, and as the younger, more creative generation were coming up with the Pandoras and streaming and all this really cool technology, these arrogant son of a bitches said, no one is ever going to be able to topple what we have because we own it.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly, all these small upstarts were eating away at the profits. And in fact, I read a really good book called Creativity by a guy named Ed. I can't remember what his last name is, but he was the founder of Pixar. And he talks about this challenge for every business to constantly be creative, no matter what industry you're in. You don't have to be in a creative industry, but to think creatively always, because there will be the next generation of whatever it is that you do who will learn from what you're doing and do it better, faster, cheaper, which is what happened in the music business. So what happens now, hopefully, is that there'll be yet another generation of music lovers who will come up with a different model than the streaming one, one where the artists are fairly compensated.
Gabe, here's from your lips to God's ears. That's all I can say to that, Erica. We won't keep you too long, but I a couple of things. First of all, the reason that I was inspired to get in touch with you and ask if you would do this was that I was, you know, in a YouTube hole watching videos of rock bands and interviews with rock bands. That's, you know, how I sort of live my life. And I came upon this interview that you did with Kurt Cobain, and I think it might have been his last interview, actually, before he died. And it's extraordinary. If you are looking for 15 minutes of really edifying, really enlightening, really kind of heartbreaking viewing, go on YouTube and find this interview that Erica did with Kurt Cobain shortly before he died. Because he is so lovely, and you put him at such ease and you disarm him. You do that brilliant thing, which every young journalist who's ever interviewed me for my band, they're like, what do musicians like to be asked about? It's like, don't fucking ask them about their music. Like, ask them about anything else but their fucking music, right? And the first question you ask him is like, what books are you reading? You know, what? And of course, that is what people want to talk about, what interests them, not what's interesting about them, unless they're Donald Trump or malignant narcissists. So, so he immediately is like, oh, cool, I get to talk about some art I like. And the conversation extends from there into a discussion about fatherhood and all kinds of things. And you really see who this person really was behind this mythology, behind this massive fame, this unbearable weight of being like an icon. And I watched and I thought, God, Erica's so good at getting him to that place. But it also kind of broke my heart because it struck me that it was like a broadcast from another planet in a way. It was a world where artists still had some private space, some place within them that was inviolate and that they didn't have to share on an Instagram post or a Twitter feed. Do you feel now, looking back on what you did, that you learned about what makes artists tick in a way that you can share with us?
All I can tell you is that when I was in grade 7, all I wanted to do was be a fly on the wall when artists were writing songs so I could understand where the magic came from. And that basically informs every one of my interviews. Like, who are you and how do you get to write that really great or sometimes shitty music? Like, how did you get to be who you are?
Yeah, because I'm assuming you interviewed Whitesnake as well, right? It's like,
it's a weird thing because I don't remember everybody I interviewed because usually there were hundreds of people that I interviewed.
Yeah.
But I don't think I interviewed them, but I interviewed, many bands that I really didn't like and many that I disliked. So, right. It was definitely challenging. And to be honest, Kurt Cobain was not a, I wasn't like a huge fan of Kurt Cobain. All I knew was that he was difficult to interview because he really didn't like mainstream media and he's like a downer earth guy. But I also heard he wasn't very nice. So when I was chosen to do the interview, they were like, good luck. I had no idea that 30 years later, it would be the defining interview of my career because it wasn't back then. It only has really come back
and
to life.
And why do you say it was the interview that defined your career?
Because in the last 5 years, it showed up on YouTube and people from around the world were able to see it and share it. And and also people were looking at it with a historical eye. So in the moment, it was a good interview. But when you understand that he took his own life soon after, there it takes on a whole other dimension.
Yeah, I mean, it seems inconceivable, to be honest. It brings out the conspiracy theorist in me because he sure didn't seem like a guy who was about to kill himself in that interview.
No. He was talking about how in love he was and why he brought his daughter into the world. Because that album that he had written was very dark. And I was actually curious, like, you're writing these songs about how ugly the world is. And you bring a child into the world, this ugly world. Why would you do it? That was the conversation that we had.
Right, right. It was, it's an amazing piece of document just of that time, but also of like a person who I think is really misunderstood or at least unknown still. And I just think about what somebody like him would have made of a world where you have to, you know, share your rigatoni recipe on Instagram in order to get yourself a record deal. It's all changed so much.
Everything has changed.
Yeah. Everything changes, but we move forward. What else can we do? Right. So we won't keep you long. One last question. The year has started. It's already a shit show, but it's going to happen whether we like it or not. What's your plans? What's going to get you through this year? And what might you say to a creative friend to swim through this year and make it?
I don't know what's going to get me through the year. I know that the podcast has been a lifeline for me because it's allowed me to connect with all my former colleagues. And it's been quite healing. It was very hard for me back then. People were not always very nice to me, watching me, especially in the early day. Now, of course, everyone goes, oh my God, I had a crush on you. I loved you. But back in the day, I got as much hate mail as I did love mail.
Oh yeah, so people were vile about the VJs at Much Music. It was very Twitterish, actually, the way people talked about the VJs
at Much
Music. But
we didn't hear it.
Right. Thank God there wasn't social media.
Right. There was, although in another episode that you really should listen to is with Jen Hollett. That's already up. She used to run the governance for Twitter. Like, she's amazing. And she talks about how when she was on air, I think it was like 2005, when the internet was already booming, she would jump into some of the forums, the Much Music forums, and people were horrific to her. So, I never experienced that. I just got letters from girls saying you're ugly, you know, I should have the job, not you, that kind of thing. And, it just kind of makes you feel bad. It wasn't terrible because I would say, haha, but I do have the job. You suck. Like, whatever. I had to get through the day. But, just my peers in the office, there was zero support from anybody. When I would go in to do my shift, there was no writers, no researchers, no directors, no producers, no makeup person, no hair person, no wardrobe. So there I was with no real skills in broadcasting, going live on national TV for 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
So I can't remember a lot of it.
Right.
Because I was in such an, I understand now that in fact, I was in such an extreme state of anxiety. I didn't realize it. I mean, I was having a great time, but there was a part of me that, your fight or flight, your cortex that is in the back of your neck, that where your fight or flight, that was, I think, on, and I was probably living on cortisol. So I can't remember much about that time. The reason why I can remember the Kurt Cobain interview is because I've seen it and it helps me remember. So if I look at old footage, I will remember.
Right. But, yes, I find that as well. Yeah.
So to answer your question, sorry, I digress all the time because I'm lonely because I'm here by myself listening to me.
That's what this podcast
is. I digress
is
a great name for a podcast, actually. I digress by Erica M.
Doing this podcast has been amazing because I'm reconnecting with people who I haven't spoken to in 30 years and meeting a lot of the new people from Much who I never met before. And then also I'm sending it out to the universe. I'm telling you guys, I'm saying it on podcasts, like I'm open for opportunities. So if you have an idea, let me collaborate with you.
Amazing.
So that's one of the things that I think is really important for people to not just hide in their rooms and kind of make a wish to the genie that something will happen, is that you have to start networking. The only reason why that guy in LA reached out to me was because, get this, 5 years ago, I was invited to go on a media trip to Israel with the top Jewish women in North America, top Jewish media women in North America. I didn't want to go. That was not my peer group. I was like, that's not how I define myself. I'm not going. And my girlfriend said to me, are you crazy? You get your ass on that plane. So I went. And I was, you know, again, I'm an introvert. So I was uncomfortable. Well, wouldn't you know it? It's one of the women from that trip who eventually I kind of connected with. We made friends. She turned out to be the VP at Jim Henson, the Jim Henson Productions. And it was her neighbor. So she told her neighbor, who was looking for a co-writer for his show, about me. I'm in Toronto. She's in LA. We haven't seen each other in 3 years. But that's how it works.
Yeah.
Is that you have to touch as many people as you can, help as many people as you can. That's an important one. Help people. Mm. You know, when people ask you to be on a podcast, do it.
Yeah.
You know, those kinds of things, like do crazy things that you never thought you would do, but connect and start building relationships with people that are not in your direct circle.
Yeah.
And you just like my whole philosophy on life is you never know. You just never know, but you have to put yourself out there and be an opportunist. And an opportunist, by the way, is not someone who takes advantage of someone to get ahead. An opportunist is someone who comes up with mutually beneficial opportunities so both parties get something out of it. That's what I am. I'm an opportunist. And that's the way you need to look at life. You have to engage with people and dream up the impossible and find a team to do it with you.
The legendary Erica M. on Soft Revolution. Thank you so much, Erica, for joining us. That is exactly what I remember it feeling like talking to her when I was doing the Stars show and she was a guest for us. Just someone who is calming. I find her calming because her opportunism, her positive opportunism, provides a kind of portal into a way of looking at this shitty time that I don't know, I find hopeful and helpful and makes me want to do things. Don't you find? She's just a great talker.
Oh, amazing.
Erica. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you, Erica, for joining us. Couple more things. Just wanted to mention that our partnership with Crow's Theater has begun, and we're very, very grateful and excited about that. You're going to see more and more of Crow's massive evil corporate influence on this podcast. Think of them as, I don't know, Exxon, and us as just a little fishing village in Scotland. No, we're just, you know, we hope that we can get some Crow's artists on the pod, and we're going to be talking to Chris Abraham, I'm hoping soon. If we've been trying to get that guy on the podcast for the last year, maybe now he's involved in it, he'll finally talk to us.
That's what's so crazy. He's like, he has his, like, you know, influence in us. You know, he doesn't even have to come on.
I know, that's right. He's like magical. The guy behind the curtain in Wizard of Oz. I just wanted to mention that if you're in Toronto, and I know you guys are in lockdown, but you get a walk, So if you're taking a walk and you're in the East End, they're doing this really cool thing at Crow's Theatre, which is called the Dundas and Carlaw Holiday Corner. They've lit up the windows of Crow's. They have these huge picture windows at Crow's, and they're filled with holiday displays, and you can get mulled wine and cocoa and stuff there. And it's going until January 30th. So if you want to like cheer yourself up and recapture a little Christmas holiday spirit, head on down to Crow's, which is right at the corner of Dundas and Carlaw in Toronto. And their restaurant, Gare de l'Est, will be offering up some lovely food and some drinks and stuff. But you can take the kids down there and get a moment of relief from the unremitting shit show that is our lives right now. Okay, that's Soft Revolution for another week. Join us next week. We're very, very, I know we say this all the time, but this is a really big one for us. We have a writer called Stephen Marsh joining us next week. He's going to talk about cultural appropriation. Stephen wrote, I think, an absolutely brilliant piece about this in the context of Canadian cultural life. He has some fascinating, challenging, you may find difficult things to hear about this subject, but we're really, really happy and grateful that he's going to come on.
So excited. He wrote, yeah. These are things, we're talking about stuff that he has written in 2017.
Yeah.
And it is as if it was like, in a time capsule.
Yeah, written yesterday.
It is unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. So we're going to be talking to him next week. Before we go, Ali, our art picks. I hear we both have Swifts this week.
I'm going to start with mine. Mine's
start
a
with
little
yours.
Bit like this. Listen, Taylor Swift's. Taylor Swift's last two
Who's
albums.
That? I've never heard of her.
Taylor's, you know, she. Listen, I'm just going to say this about Taylor Swift. To
just
all
what
the
Taylor Swift needs is some more publicity.
I know. To all of Taylor's ex-boyfriends, thank you. No, not thank you if you caused her any pain, but thank you for the inspiration. And in fact, I'm wondering if Taylor Swift is getting into relationships
just so she can write these songs.
Yeah. You know, this it's incredible. And I'm going to play a song that she has with Bon Iver called Evermore, which is the title of her album. Freaking just amazing. You know what? Just succumb. And it's actually pretty cool. She's 31 now. We all kind of grew up with Taylor Swift. We saw her as like a kid all the way now. And you could just see just how mature her music is becoming and how deep it's becoming and rich it's becoming. And whatever you thought of Taylor Swift, she always was a really, I think at her core, just an incredibly talented songwriter with deep roots in like tradition, you know?
Yeah. And let me say this about Taylor Swift. You know, nobody has fought harder for other artists in terms of streaming revenue and fair treatment by record labels, et cetera, than Taylor Swift has. She's put a lot of money on the line, and she has stood up for other artists, not just herself.
Yes.
And I got lots of respect for that lady. She works her ass off, she's good. So we're going to hear some of that.
One day you're going to have to explain to me why she has to re-record all her stuff, because I still can't figure
that
out.
I'll do that next week.
You can tell my next week. Yeah.
For the same reason I might have to, which is that some fucking scumbag owns it. Anyway, we'll talk more about that next week. My pick is also a Swift, and it's very, very old. It's a short essay. I urge you all to read it. It's called A Modest Proposal, and some of you may know it. And it's by the great satirist Jonathan Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels. And it is a very reasonably put, very mild and moderate, but very logical argument that says we should eat babies. And the reason that I think it's so relevant right now is because it is exactly the kind of rhetoric that I have heard from bottom-feeding, soulless monsters like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and Mitch McConnell and all the enablers of Donald Trump. All of the smooth-talking, suit-wearing, grinning CNN panelist fuckers who have put this man in the position to wreak the havoc that he has. And their fascism has always been couched in this sort of mild language. Everybody's getting so excited. You know, all we're trying to do is legally count every vote and yada, yada, yada. This kind of rhetoric continues. It continues to act as a disguise for the most extreme, abhorrent behavior and policies. And we have got to stop falling for it. So I urge you, make Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal go viral. get on whatever page you use and send a tweet, send a link to your friends and make them read this thing. Because so often our political class disguises death and suffering and pain and carelessness and incompetence in mild, bureaucratic, academic language. And it's happening all over the world right now, and it's enough with it. So that's my pick. It'll take you 10 minutes. Read A Modest Proposal. It's also extremely funny because he actually does kind of convince you that maybe eating babies is not the stupidest idea you've ever heard. And that is where we're at now, folks. You know, if we can, if QAnon can be real, then anything can be real. And we have got to be on guard against irrationality dressed up as rationality. And that's what the internet does better than anybody. So that's it, folks. For another week, that's Soft Revolution. I'm Torkel Campbell. That's Ali Moman. Stay safe. Please, please don't go out if you don't have to. We know it sucks. It sucks for us too. I'm going crazy, but we're together and we're going to make it through this bullshit. We'll see you next week. Love you, brother.
See you next week. Love you, man. Bye.
Gray November, I've been down since July. Motion capture put me in a bad light. I replay my footsteps on each stepping stone, trying to find the one where I went wrong. Writing letters addressed to the fire, and I was catching my breath, staring out an open window, catching my death. And I couldn't be sure, I had a feeling so peculiar, that this pain would be for evermore. Hey December, guess I'm feeling unmoored. Can't remember what I used to fight for. I rewind the tape, but all it does is pause on the very moment I was lost, sending signals to be double-crossed. And I was catching my breath, barefoot in the wildest winter, catching my death. And I couldn't be sure, I had a feeling so peculiar, that this pain would be forevermore. My breath. floors of a cabin creaking under my step. And I couldn't be sure. I had a feeling so peculiar.